From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Parvati Mukherjee. She grew up in India. Her romantic fantasies were shaped by Hollywood movies, but her parents expected her to have an arranged marriage, which she rejected. Her new novel, Desirable Daughters, is about how three Indian sisters maintain or reject traditional customs, including arranged marriage. Also, Gerard Jones tells us how he wrestled with how violent to make his superhero comic books. He's written for Spider-Man, Batman, and Pokemon. His new book is about children, superheroes, and make-believe violence. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews the Blasters' 2-CD compilation, The Blasters' Testament, The Complete Slash Recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli troops extended their offensive into the West Bank today, fighting with Palestinian gunmen in Ramallah and moving into other Palestinian towns. Israeli leaders said the offensive was aimed at destroying terrorist infrastructure and that the troops were under orders to avoid civilian casualties. Palestinians said the Israeli action amounted to state terrorism against civilians. A car blew up near downtown Jerusalem, killing the Palestinian driver and seriously injuring an Israeli policeman who was investigating. Israeli police said the driver was apparently headed for a suicide attack on a more populous area when he was stopped. A man who appears to be one of Osama bin Laden's highest-ranking associates has been captured in Pakistan. Officials say he's expected to be transferred to U.S. custody at Guantanamo Bay. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
U.S. officials are pretty sure the man is Abu Zubaydah, a 30-year-old top al-Qaeda planner who has been linked to several terrorist attacks. He was captured in a raid last week carried out by Pakistani police and agents from the FBI and CIA. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld would neither confirm nor deny Zubaydah's capture.
One of the single most important things we can do is to gather intelligence information. And when one's gathering information and then piecing things together, It is helpful to be able to do that in an environment that not everyone in the world knows precisely what kind of information you may have.
The U.S. military has made capturing senior al-Qaeda officials a top goal. Zubaydah would be the first. Emily Harris, NPR News, the Pentagon.
There's a split at a major international conference on terrorism being held in Malaysia. Some 50 member countries of the Organization of the Islamic Conference are trying to come up with a definition of terrorism, hoping the United Nations will follow suit. Ryan Melzer reports from the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur.
There was one resolution all the Muslim countries agreed on. It accused Israel of pushing the Middle East toward all-out war and called for the UN to intervene. But delegates were divided on the culpability of the Palestinians. Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad is a frequent critic of Israel's, but he suggested that suicide bombers who killed Israeli civilians were also terrorists. Mahathir said that no matter how bitter and angry Muslims felt, they must show the world that they could act rationally when fighting for their rights. The Palestinian foreign minister disagreed. He said the suicide bombers were driven to sacrifice their lives because of the Israeli occupation. He branded Israel's actions as the worst kind of terrorism. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Meltzer in Kuala Lumpur.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 41 points to close at 10,362 in moderate trading of about 1 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 17 points to close at 1,862. This is NPR News. Xerox Corporation has agreed to pay $10 million to settle allegations that it violated securities laws. The copier maker said it would also restate its financial reports or results for the last several years. The settlement comes after a nearly two-year investigation of Xerox's accounting practices by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Indiana Hoosiers take on the University of Maryland Terrapins in tonight's men's college basketball championship game. Maryland's expected to win, but being the underdog so far hasn't affected Indiana on its surprising run through the tournament. NPR's Tom Goldman has this report.
While Indiana has the basketball tradition and five national titles, this Hoosiers team at the beginning of the tournament was not considered championship caliber. But with dead-eye outside shooting and relentless hustle, they made it to the final, stunning favored Duke and Oklahoma along the way. It's been particularly satisfying for second-year coach Mike Davis, who replaced the legendary and volatile Bobby Knight. Davis has brought a very un-Bobby Knight-like calm to Indiana basketball, with his smiles and self-effacing comments like, "I'm just a basketball coach." He'll have to be a very good coach against the Terrapins, who believe they should have played for the title last year when they lost in the semifinals to Duke after leading by 22 points. This time, many believe Maryland will win the title because of dominant big men and the brilliant play of senior guard Juan Dixon. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Stock prices fell today despite positive news on manufacturing and construction spending. The Institute for Supply Management said its index of business activity rose for the second month in a row. The Commerce Department said spending on construction was up more than 1%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Parity Mukherjee, writes about what she describes as America's new immigrants. She's written five novels, two nonfiction books, and two collections of short stories, one of which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Mukherjee was born in Calcutta, India, in 1940, to a wealthy Brahmin family. After studying literature in India, she attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the early 60s, which is where she met her husband. She became an American citizen in 1988. This is not the life her parents had intended for her. In fact, they planned an arranged marriage, which she rejected. Arranged marriage is one of the traditions at the heart of Mukherjee's new novel, Desirable Daughters. It's about three sisters who come from a family similar to Mukherjee's. Each sister has a different approach to maintaining or rejecting the traditions of the culture. Like Mukherjee's new novel, the new film Monsoon Wedding looks at arranged marriage versus romantic love. I asked Mukherjee how common arranged marriages are in India now.
It's still very common. In fact, I have my only nephew, who's 28 years old, living with me for 2 years while he goes to MBA school in San Francisco, who's going through the arranged marriage only via the internet rather than actual marriage brokers coming to your house, knocking on the door.
He's doing it through the internet? How?
The proposals come via the internet, and so his parents forward them to us in San Francisco, and he's also on email to young Indo-American women or young Indian women on H-1B visas, whom he hasn't seen, but it's email getting to know each other.
Well, that's a kind of interesting mix of tradition and modern technology.
Right, right. It's a 21st century version of hanging on to traditions. But in a way, I feel that it makes it even harder to know who you're hooking up with.
Does he want an arranged marriage?
Yes, this young man very much so.
Why?
I think he needs that certainty, and he intends to go back to India after he finishes his degree and gets maybe a year or two of work experience. He wants to have the option of going back.
So he wants the certainty of what? Of knowing that he'll have a partner? Because he doesn't have the certainty of knowing he'll love the person.
He, I think, assumes that love only blossoms after marriage, and perhaps this is like an MBA student. He wants to avoid the chaos of emotional ups and downs that I and my characters so wholeheartedly embrace.
Yes, well, you were supposed to have an arranged marriage. Your parents had selected a man for you when you were, still a teenager and living in India. Had you asked them to do that, or did they just take that on themselves?
Oh, no, they took it upon themselves. There was never any question of expressing my wishes, ideas, politics. My father decided what we wore, what opinions we had on trivial and important things, and we simply mouthed them.
Well, how did you say no to your parents?
Impulse. I think very much like Tara, the narrator, in Desirable Daughters, I found that the moment that I hit Iowa as a graduate student, that it was the beginning of the making of a consciousness, that I'd come out of such a protected world. I feel now, there was no bubble wrap in those days, but I feel now that in a way I was bubble wrapped in innocence and kept away from any kind of possibility of breaking rules or thinking bad thoughts. So that the moment I came here to the United States, it became an occasion for me to try out all the subterraneous personalities that I had learned to conceal from adults.
When you told your parents that you didn't want the arranged marriage, what was their reaction?
Actually, mine was even more dramatic or melodramatic than that. I sent a cable to my father saying, by the time you get this, I'll already be married. So there was very little that my wonderfully patriarchal father could do about the situation. I fell in love over a two-week courtship with a fellow student in the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, writer named Clark Blaze. That was 38 years ago, by the way. And we got married during a lunch break in the lawyer's office above the coffee shop. That lawyer's office is still there in Iowa City.
And you're still married.
And I'm still married.
So were your parents very angry with you? Did they accept that this was your choice and that you'd be happy?
They were devastated that I'd had the guts or the audacity to take a decision on my own. They'd never expected me to break any kind of parental rule. Or I'd been very careful not to expose my very emotional nature to them.
Your novel, Desirable Daughters, is about three sisters. One of them stays in India. Two of them come to America. Do you have any siblings who stayed behind in India?
I have one. My youngest sister stays in India. And it's her one and only son who is now living with us in San Francisco and going to school here.
Right. Is her life and your life very different?
It's very much like the Parvati character. Her life is very much like that of the Parvati character in the novel, the one who stays in Bombay and is the wife of a senior corporate man. She has been the bridge, or made herself a bridge, between modern India traditions and at the same time rebelled against my father's choice of husband for her.
So she didn't have an arranged marriage?
No, none of us did. My poor father tried so hard, and each of us three sisters went our own ways.
Gee, that makes it seem all the more remarkable that your nephew would choose an arranged marriage, considering his parents didn't have one.
I wonder if that's a kind of a reaction. His traditionalism is a kind of reaction against the impulsiveness of his mother and aunts. And I see that in some ways with the first-generation Indo-Americans, who quite often are far more Indian and profess to be far more Indian in their love of culture or in their attitudes than the Indian counterparts living in big cities in India or the immigrant generation who knew that they must let go something.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Parvati Mukherjee, and her new novel, Desirable Daughters, has to do with arranged marriage. It's about three sisters who are from India, two who live in the United States. Although you grew up in a Hindu family, you went to a convent school. Why would Hindu parents send you to an Irish Catholic convent school?
Oh, that's still quite common. That was the pattern, certainly when I was going to school, that if you were from what we called one of the best families in town, then you went to, if you were a girl, you went to Loretta House on Middleton Row, fancy formerly British area, to this convent run by Irish nuns from Galway. And if you were a male child, you were sent to St. Xavier's College, also in the same area, which was run by Jesuit priests from Belgium. And so we kept our school lives, where we celebrated St. Patrick's Day with shamrock flown out of Galway, and our Hindu home life, very, very separate.
So what exactly were the advantages of going to the convent school? Was it that you were getting a Western education? Or?
It was very hard to get into that school, and it was really about how respected your family was in town. And so going there meant you were assured excellent bridegroom prospects.
I see.
And, yeah, and good manners, and very well guarded. We were chaperoned all the time.
I see. I think, isn't your book, you say, that it also assured that you were going to be a virgin?
Yes, yes, absolutely. But it's just that all that was fraudulent, I realize now, as does my narrator, Tara, that we kept the appearance of absolute purity and absolute innocence to the point of naivety. But there were rebellions going on, only you learned how to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
Also had, by the way, the two most important classes in that school were elocution and table manners.
How'd you react to that?
Loved it.
Really?
Yes.
What did you love about learning table manners?
We were told by the nuns that our girls can go to any big city in the world, Paris, London, New York, and they'll know how to conduct themselves. And we thought that was a pretty cool thing to be. And the elocution was we read plays out loud. We had play reading groups. Oscar Wilde, Noel Coward, all these. I could do all the parts as if I were an English male of a certain generation.
And when you came to the United States, what year was that?
1961, fall of 1961.
So you came to the United States and got married before the women's movement of the late 60s.
The movement, meaning Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook and Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, were just beginning to be read, 63 and so on. So I was very much here in the United States as people were getting taking aggressive or self-assertive acts to equalize rights.
Now, as an inveterate reader and as a novelist, what are the books that really reached you that spoke about the woman's condition in the 60s and that inspired you to map out your life?
It was a mixture. I loved The Golden Notebook. But I also loved Emma Bovary and her misguided attempts to liberate herself from what I saw as a very provincial kind of repression of her free spirit. So it was everything combined. But the most important narrative to me was my own life, the experiences I was having, because I was while other women, my women friends, were throwing pots or trying out painting.
You're making pottery when you say throwing pots.
Yes, sorry. making pottery, going to art classes, you know, working with their hands, nice clay medium. And they were also going to consciousness-raising groups and examining themselves with mirrors and so on. I was, you know, too shy to look at my body. I still can't do those tests for finding, tumors in one's breasts. I'm that not at ease with my body, I guess. And certainly the whole idea of consciousness raising, where you write down what the husband's duties are about taking out garbage or doing the gardening and who does the dishes when, all those kinds of things struck me as so irrelevant to my life, where Clark and I had small children. We were both going to school. I was getting my PhD. I was teaching full time and bringing up, going to the laundromat to clean diapers before going off to teach. That, you know, I had no time for that kind of thinking through feminist agenda.
My guest is Bharati Mukherjee. Her new novel is called Desirable Daughters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Bharati Mukherjee. Her new novel, Desirable Daughters, is about three Indian sisters and how each deals with maintaining or rejecting the traditions they were brought up with. Mukherjee was born in Calcutta and has lived in North America since the early 60s. When did you know you wanted to write?
From age 3. I was a precocious child. And I lived in stories, inside stories.
Would your family have considered it acceptable for you to be a writer?
Because I was a woman, and as long as I wasn't writing anything that might be considered rude, such as sex, mm-hmm. violence, mm-hmm. It would be okay, yes. They thought of it as an accomplishment, womanly accomplishment. Gift of the pen is what the phrase they used.
And have you written about sex or things that are rude?
I'm afraid so. And for my characters, including Tara, sexuality becomes a favored way of expressing revolution, trying out a life outside the box.
Is it hard for you to write that way, since you said you're too uncomfortable to even do self-exams?
No. I think, for me, my fiction is a way of getting in touch with my inner bad girl. And so, you know, I want in my fantasies to be a cross between Rita Hayworth and Diana Ross.
And not the Hindu convent girl.
No. And once I'm in that mode, you know, inside the character,
anything goes.
I can do bad things.
No, I've read that there was a period when you, of a few years when you lived in Canada, and that this
14 years, yeah.
And that overlap with the period when several thousand refugees left Idi Amin's Uganda, and about 5,000 of those refugees, people who were formerly, I think, from India.
They were second and third generation Ugandans of
Asian descent.
Asian, yes. And they had British passports, which mm-hmm. Britain did not honor. And so the Canadian Prime Minister of that time, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, very kindly offered them residence, green cards. And that caused a sudden, really unanticipated, at least by me, backlash against brown immigrants. And the government didn't react to control that backlash in the way that it should have.
Why do you think there was a backlash, and how did it directly affect you?
Oh, dear. It meant that anyone with a brown face in cities like Toronto, Vancouver, was fair game for physical harassment as well as verbal harassment on the street. And so, you know, there were incidents every day. And I was a victim of many such incidents of not being served in stores or being roughed up by teenagers in blue jeans overalls in subway, on subway platforms, or being, you know, thrown out of lobbies of fancy hotels if my white husband wasn't near me, or being given secondary examination in airports, or racial profiling. And there was no, in the Canada of those early 70s to late 70s, in fact, through the 70s, there was no constitution in Canada. The constitution hadn't yet been repatriated. And so there was no Bill of Rights. There was no legal agency of redress against race-based hate crime.
What must have been particularly odd for you during that experience in Canada, when you felt that there was a lot of backlash, you had come from a very elite family in Calcutta. Your family
yes.
was wealthy. You were among...
We were brought up to think well of ourselves and that our ideas mattered.
Right. So it must have been a very kind of educational experience to suddenly be perceived not as the elite, but as the inferior, and to have people, you know, even attacking you because of that. I'm sure you could use a lot
yes.
of words other than educational to describe that experience, but I'm sure someone like you really walked away from
it was
that
devastating.
Learning a lot, yeah.
Yes, it was totally, totally devastating to me to be seen as, you know, an unwanted Canadian, mm-hmm. as a smelly immigrant, a potential burglar and con artist and so on. And it made me reassess my status, my own attitudes towards minorities in India while I had been growing up, how unconsciously racist or ethnicist I may have been myself in relation to Indian minorities. And having been an elite in Calcutta, brought up to believe that my ideas matter, meant that I had the gutsiness to take on government officials in Canada and say, you can't do this, this is not right, and I know what's right, and I'm jolly well going to tell you how to set it right. It didn't work, but, you know, I was caught in two simultaneous roles. One as someone who's very confident of herself and knows right from wrong and feels very strongly about civil rights, human rights, and the other who feels impotent that there'll be no change in the way that the country thinks. I'm so glad, though, I've been proved wrong and that Canada is a very habitable place.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bharati Mukherjee is the author of the new novel, Desirable Daughters. She's a professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Gerard Jones on writing superhero comics and watching how his readers reacted to the violence. His new book is called Killing Monsters. And Ed Ward reviews the new Blasters double CD compilation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gerard Jones, is a comic book fan turned comic book writer. He's written for the series Batman, Spider-Man, and Pokemon. He's also the author of a book about comics called Comic Book Heroes. Questions about the impact of violent pop culture on children have followed him throughout his life. As a child, his mother was reluctant to let him read superhero comics because of the violence. Later, as the author of superhero comics, he had to figure out how violent to make his stories. Now he's written a new book called Killing Monsters that argues that children need some make-believe violence. When he was a child, his mother thought a lot of pop culture was crude. I asked how he started reading comics.
I was going through a pretty classic middle school depression. I was not finding anything to interest me. I was cutting school. I was going out late at night on these long walks. I was looking for something, but nothing was working for me. And my mom was an English teacher in high school, and one of her students was a kid sort of like me, kind of a brainy, geeky kid, but much more settled in his society. And I had some good friends, and he was always into some interesting projects. And his big passion of the time was Marvel Comics, and he did a independent study report on them for my mom. And my mom had a huge bias against comics since the 50s, really. That was the one thing that she had disliked from very early on because of the furor about it, the Senate investigation of violence in comics. And she decided that because this kid liked these so much and was proselytizing them so strongly, that she would actually borrow some and bring them home. So I found myself suddenly gifted by my mother with these crass, crude, violent entertainments, and I glommed onto them instantly.
Which comics did she bring home for you, and how did she choose those?
She just asked this kid, Jack, to loan her something, and he decided to just give her all of the preceding month's Marvels. He was still looking at that month, so I got just an assortment of these things: Daredevil, Fantastic Four, Captain America. But the one that really got me was the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk, because I was looking back. I couldn't have articulated this at the time, but looking back, I saw myself as ineffective, as scrawny, and as unable to change my world. And I also was going through a lot of anger that, trying very hard to be a good boy, I was not expressing. And then here was this character in the comics who was a geeky, mild scientist who, because of being hit by gamma rays, would become the Hulk when he was angry. He would feel the rage coming up, and he would suddenly realize, no, I can't give in to the rage, I can't let this happen. But then the transformation would begin, and he would become a huge, over-muscled, green brute, and tear out of his clothes, and lose most of his mental functions, but have all his passions completely unapologetically, and he would go stomping around and destroying buildings and fighting with the army and defeating bad guys along the way. He always ended up being on the side of the angels, but without having to subscribe to social codes, just by virtue of sensing who was hurting who and who to fight. And this was something that really spoke to me intensely. I didn't realize it then, but I could be the Hulk. I could tap into this rage that I was bottling up, and I could explode, and maybe I could change the world.
When you started writing for the comics, what was your attitude about violent stories or the portrayal of violence? How much had you internalized your parents' and teachers' feelings that, you know, violent fantasies were bad for children?
It was interesting to discover, and it took me a while even to notice them. I would do superhero stories. I would write fight scenes, as I had to. But I found myself pulling back. I found myself doing many more talking scenes than the average comic book writer. I found myself going into the subtleties of character. My editors would even get a little frustrated that it took me too long sometimes to get to the suspense, to get to the action. And that was something for me to look at. I realized that even though I didn't mind the fight scenes when I read them, and I understood that this was part of the charm of the genre, I was not going all the way into them. I was backing off. And now I can see that this was about this very early sense that my own anger and violent fantasies and love of big conflictive action was something I was really ambivalent about. And I was half-consciously taking it upon myself to lift these superheroes out of that material, which made for some pretty good smart stories, but it also really limited them, because these characters were born of physical conflict, and they're meant to be metaphors of power versus power. And so I was pulling away from the essence of them. And although I was a pretty popular writer, that prevented me, I think, from really connecting strongly with my readers. And it was at a comic book convention in 94 that I had a conversation with a girl, a 13-year-old girl, who was a big fan of one of my comics called Freaks. And what she focused on, what she said she liked best, which surprised me, was the fight scenes. It wasn't the subtle character interplay, and it wasn't the talk. She liked that too, but she said it was in the fight scenes that you could really see the character's passion, and clearly that's when they became alive for her. And there were probably many conversations I could have had that would have started me thinking, but that was the one. I thought, here's this very meek, mild, self-restrained 13-year-old girl, not quite the, you know, the usual, the idea, the stereotype of the comic book fan, saying that she really got something out of the fights. And I was thinking of myself at the same age, the Hulk, what this violence meant to me, this make-believe violence. And that's when I really started looking in my writing and in my emotions, my thoughts. What does this mean to me? Why is it so powerful? And yet, why do I shy away from it, too?
You've written comics and you've written about comics. Do you think the violent fantasies in comics have changed over the decades?
Yeah, one of the big changes that I found distressing as a middle-aged writer of them was the rise of anger in the characters. And that was one of the things that really got me thinking, okay, where are kids now and what's going on in them? Because the comics I grew up on, the Hulk was an angry character, but he was pretty unusual. He was almost goofy because of his extreme anger. Most of the heroes were calm. You know, you had Superman was always smiling, and Batman was usually grim but not rageful. And then around 1980, there was this huge upswelling of the almost dementedly angry hero. And even Superman now is all grimacing, and his hair's wild, and he's sweating. And it was at that point that I started asking, what are kids so mad about? And I think one of the things that they're so mad about is just the fact that nobody's listening to their anger, so they need to see it reflected back more and more in their pop culture.
My guest is Gerard Jones. He's written superhero comics. His new book, Killing Monsters, is about children and make-believe violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerard Jones. He's written comic books for the superhero series Batman, Spider-Man, and Pokemon. His new book is about superheroes, violent fantasies, and their impact on children. It's called Killing Monsters.
Were there women characters when you were writing comic books?
Yeah, there were, but that's a huge shift in pop culture really recently. There would either be the Invisible Girl in the Fantastic Four, and the name Invisible Girl, says it all. Yes, she was shy and retiring and dependent on her husband and the whole thing. And then there was good old Wonder Woman, who was kind of the only superheroine who really had a following, mostly a little girl following. The girls would kind of dump her as they got up toward the preteen years. And scattered here and there, there were attempts to do these sort of lame feminist heroines who would come in screaming about male chauvinist pigs, and those, of course, died instantly. But when I got back looking at comics in the 80s, and as the last decade and a half have gone by, I've seen it more and more, is just this huge variety of female characters. And they don't look that varied. If you just look at, because they're all tiny-waisted, big-breasted, and not very thoroughly covered, let's put it that way. But within that, this is the huge gamut of the cold, competent one, and the angry one, and the tender, protective one, and then combinations thereof. And I think this humanization of the made-up violent female is one of the best things that's happened in pop culture recently, and it's shifting. The audience is responding. More and more little girls now are into action entertainment than ever before, and I think they're forcing the material to change too.
As you pointed out, the women in action comics are usually very scantily clad and very big-breasted. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to draw characters like that?
I never liked those characters. I didn't draw. I wrote. So I'd script them, and then you know the artist would turn them in looking like that. I still have some problems with that. I would like to see more body types out there for girls, but as I caught on to the fact that there were a lot of girls who loved these characters, and then in looking at other media like the Mortal Kombat, there's a scantily clad, gorgeous martial arts fighter who turned out to be a favorite of both boy and girl players, and of course Tomb Raider, you know, Lara Croft. It struck me that to some extent what these girls are is what Batman or Superman or the Hulk was to me. As a little kid, I was scrawny, other kids are obese, but no kid is really that comfortable with his physicality yet. He's, if nothing else, he's too small. To be able to pretend to be these big, super-muscled characters for a while, it doesn't make them feel bad about themselves or think they have to abuse themselves to become that nearly as often as it enables them to be that for a while. In Fantasyland, they can be that perfect masculine stereotype, and then it's actually easier to be yourself. And I found this a lot with girls. They can be Lara Croft, even though they don't look anything like Lara Croft, and no, they won't. And then they go back to themselves, but that Lara Croft fantasy is still there. It's sort of like somebody our age who loves pretending to be Audrey Hepburn, in a sense. You know, you look at an Audrey Hepburn movie, and you're her for 2 hours, but you come back and you don't hate yourself for not being Audrey Hepburn. You're still kind of Audrey Hepburn in your real life.
You were one of the people who translated Pokemon, which started as a Japanese comic. You translated it into an American market. Mm-hmm. So it already existed, but it existed in a different culture. So is Pokemon still really popular? It was such a big craze a couple of years ago. Where is it now?
It still has its diehards. There's still little kids who are really into just the funny characters and watching the cartoon. It's still profitable for them, I'm pretty sure of that. Mm-hmm. And it still has a lot of older kids who play the games. But when a fad is that hot, it almost always breaks quickly. And I think what happens, kids don't like to feel that they're being jerked around by the adult world. And obviously they get jerked around a lot by the adult world. But when they really catch on that they're expected to be into something like Pokemon, and it's being marketed at them everywhere they turn, a lot of them turn against it. My son, Nicky, was just, he hated Pokemon. He would, or mostly he'd pretend to hate Pokemon. He'd cover his ears if anybody said the word. For a while, he liked Digimon, which I don't think he really liked, except it was the competition. So this proved he didn't like Pokemon because he was into Digimon. Then he lost interest in that. So it's there. I think it's a very vital fantasy for kids. I think it's one of the best pop culture creations for kids in recent years. And because of that, I don't think it's going to go away. But I think the marketing kind of killed it, frankly, because it started as a schoolyard craze. It was not turned into a craze by marketing, and I think the marketing popped the bubble.
This may sound like an odd question to ask an adult, but if you could be any superhero, which one would you choose to be now?
That's a good one. You know, when I was in the business, I was always drawn to Batman because he was so rational in his control. He was so smart all the time. Who would I be now? It's sort of like the one I would want to be kind of isn't there. In a way, I'm actually kind of drawn to Lara Croft. There's something about being this girl with some girly sensibilities who's also so incredibly powerful and able to do what has to be done.
Now, you mentioned Batman. Didn't you do a comic with Batman and Robin, which had this whole like musical generation gap thing going where Robin really liked rock and roll and Batman was opposed to it?
Yeah, that was actually the last superhero comic I wrote. I wrote some Pokemon stuff after that, but that was it for the costumed characters. And that was kind of a statement on in a way these same themes that we get scared by something that we don't understand, and we confuse our own anxieties about it with the actual effect it's having on the person who's into it. So it was kind of celebrating Robin's discovery of this forbidden rebel world, and Batman having to realize that he can have that world, but he's still Robin. He's still going to be there for him.
So Batman was like the responsible parent or teacher saying, this is bad for you, and Robin was the kid discovering exciting new stuff.
Yeah, Batman was the one who was blurring fantasy and reality, because he would see all the dark and rebellious and destructive imagery in The Rock and think, well, therefore this is teaching people to be that. And Robin was the one who was getting that. No, I'm still the boy wonder I always was, but I like to go here for play. It's a difference between media as teacher versus media as playground, and I think entertainment's usually a playground, and that's what Robin had to hit Batman to in the course of that story.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Gerard Jones has written superhero comics. His new book is called Killing Monsters. This evening, guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs at their 16th annual award ceremony. Let's listen to Bucky Pizzarelli playing a guitar duet with his son, John Pizzarelli, from their album Contrasts. This is Coquette, featuring Bucky playing lead. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the Blasters' new double CD compilation. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Brother bands are an integral part of American popular music. Bands like the Delmore Brothers, the Leuven Brothers, and the Everly Brothers. Rock historian Ed Ward adds the Alvin Brothers, Dave and Phil, to that list. A new compilation of their 80s band, the Blasters, is the occasion for Ed's examination of the Alvin Brothers' brief career together.
There have been lots of roots rock revival bands over the years, groups that fasten onto a given genre like rockabilly or western swing and play forgotten classics and attempt original songs to play alongside them. But the Blasters were something else entirely. For one thing, unlike most of the roots bands which preceded them, they were working-class kids from Downey, an industrial suburb of Los Angeles. For another, while they'd pepper their live shows with cover songs to keep the audience happy, they really concentrated on original material, which, given that Dave Alvin was such a prolific and talented songwriter, was a very good thing indeed.
Murray, Murray, playing guitar on the back porch. I sit in my car. Why she sings so sad, Murray, Murray. Murray, Murray, it's so lonely in these farmlands. Please come with me to the bright lights downtown, Murray, Murray.
The four original Blasters, Dave and Phil Alvin, bassist John Baz, and drummer Bill Bateman, were all music fanatics who hung out together during the 70s, playing in bands and haunting record stores. They also got to know some of the local celebrities, guys who'd been part of the L.A. scene of the late 40s, like Lloyd Glenn, Big Joe Turner, Lee Allen, and T-Bone Walker. They eventually came together to make their own music and found Rockin' Ronnie Weiser, a record dealer and rockabilly fanatic who had a label of sorts, and cut an album on them. On It was a gem in the form of Marie Marie, which helped them get gigs in the clubs where punk was raging. The Blasters weren't punks, but they played songs which resonated with the scene.
Well, you were soldier boy on deep in West Berlin. Don't you think that rocks just 1,000 violins? They want to hear some American music. American music. They want to hear that sound that from the USA. Well, it could be sweet and lovely. It could be hard and mean. One thing. It's always on the beam. They want to hear some American music. American music. They want to hear that sound that from the USA. Well, it's a howl from the desert.
Their arrival on the scene coincided with LA's top punk band, X, reassessing their own direction, and the two bands soon became friends. A sort of neo-roots scene began to develop with the arrival of a third band, Los Lobos, and they all began exchanging ideas and playing each other's gigs. Soon, the Blasters had a deal with Slash, a Warner-subsidized label that documented a lot of the best L.A. bands, including Los Lobos, who the Blasters brought to the label's attention. The Blasters' first real album, the Ronnie Weiser one, sounded awful, blew critics away and established them as a new voice.
I know I've been fooling myself too long. I never right, but always wrong. Goodbye, baby, so long. You know, there was a cold wind blowing on the night we met. The leaves fell from the trees. You made a lot of promises I ain't seen yet. I ain't gonna ask you, please. You know.
The essential Dave Alvin Blaster song was one which zeroed in on the down and outer, the loner, the alienated person on the fringes of a big industrial society he didn't quite understand or fit into. These portraits were unlike anything rock and roll had seen up to that point, and they were totally believable.
I found a home in room 16 for 3 long weeks. This is where I've been. I could try to call you on the phone. I got the call.
can't put them in. Just stop.
The problem was, the stories were too real, and so were the band. They added a piano player, an old Downey pal, Gene Taylor, and often performed with saxophonist Lee Allen, who'd played on Little Richard's records, and countless other classics. But despite the Allen Brothers' hairstyles, they weren't the Stray Cats. The songs were strong, but maybe too strong for a very timid radio market. With their third album, Hard Line, they hired a radio-friendly producer, and also had a single produced and written by John Cougar Mellencamp.
Look at me. I'm too embarrassed to talk to you, 'cause every eye that I see, every guy in this room is looking to talk only to you. How do you talk to an angel? I wish I knew. And when the room goes dark, they're gonna turn on the colored lights.
It didn't help. The pressure to write hits resulted in Dave Alvin writing stuff that came close to self-parody. And although none of it is bad, none of it is classic blasters either. The brothers were already at each other's throats. The label was probably going to drop them. And so sometime in 1985, Dave Alvin left the band, and Phil, a talented mathematician, went back to UCLA to get a degree. Dave joined one of the later versions of X and then became a superb solo artist and producer, and Phil later emerged with bands called the Blasters, which continued to tour. But the magic of the original band was gone, even if echoes of what they invented can be heard all over America today.
Writer Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The new Blasters compilation is on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Mones, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the modern industrial steak. It comes from cattle that are fed corn instead of grass, along with side dishes of antibiotics and hormones. We talk with journalist Michael Pollan about his Sunday New York Times Magazine cover story. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.